You know how you can look at a photograph and depending on how you crop it, the entire story of what's happening just totally changes.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if you zoom in on two people holding hands, you're like, oh, it's a romance. But if you pan out and see they're standing on the edge of a burning building, suddenly, boom, it's a thriller.
Right, completely different vibe.
Exactly. The physical reality didn't change at all, you know? But your understanding of it completely flipped. Welcome to the deep dive.
Glad to be back.
So last time we saw President Truman look at Iran and basically see a local business dispute. But today we're getting into what happens when a new president takes office, screws a totally new filter onto the lens, and suddenly that same dispute looks like World War III.
Yeah, we left off last time with a very specific, almost contained picture of the early 1950s.
Right.
The United States, under a Democratic president, Harry Truman, was staring at this massive headache in the Middle East. Iran's prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, had just nationalized the country's oil industry.
Which was hu
Huge. He effectively took it back from this massive British monopoly.
And the British government was, I mean, they were absolutely livid about it.
Well,
They were
furious.
begging Washington to help them overthrow Mossadegh, but Truman essentially just said no. Like
Yeah.
he invited Mossadegh to Washington. He wanted to sit down and negotiate.
Exactly. He saw a sovereign nation flexing its muscles, reclaiming its resources. It was tense, sure, but it wasn't an existential crisis for the United States.
Right. It was just business.
That is the baseline we established. But our mission today is to unpack this massive historical pivot.
The big shift.
Right. Historians often refer to it as the Republican reversal. We're going to examine how a single change in the Oval Office in late 1952 flipped Washington's foreign policy completely upside down.
It's wild how fast it happens, too.
It really is. It transforms this localized argument over oil revenues into a massive Cold War domino. And ultimately, it paves the way for one of the most consequential covert operations of the 20th century.
Because the central question here for you listening is, like, how does the exact same geopolitical situation, the same country, same prime minister, same oil, produce the exact opposite response from the US in just a matter of months?
Well, the shift begins, fundamentally, with the U.S. presidential election in November 1952. Dwight D. Eisenhower, a Republican and the former Supreme Allied Commander in World War II, wins the White House.
Right.
And he and his incoming team, they just bring a drastically different worldview to Washington.
Yeah, and when we talk about a different worldview, I mean, we aren't just talking about minor foreign policy tweaks here. Eisenhower's administration was deeply, heavily committed to this strategy of global anti-communist containment.
Exactly. I mean, the Truman administration had built the early architecture of the Cold War, obviously, but they still evaluated conflicts case by case.
They didn't see communists under every bed.
Right. They looked at Iran and saw British colonial overreach clashing with Iranian nationalism. Eisenhower's team didn't look at the globe that way at all.
No, everything was connected.
To them, containment meant that every single international conflict, no matter how remote, was a potential front line with the Soviet Union.
Wow.
Yeah, any instability was basically a vacuum that Moscow might just swoop in and fill.
So wait, applying that to our camera lens metaphor from earlier, it's like the landscape itself hasn't moved an inch, right? But when the Eisenhower administration screws on this new containment filter, the shadows suddenly look like monsters.
That's a perfect way to put it. The new filter completely alters how they react to the picture.
Because where Truman saw an economic negotiation, the incoming administration immediately views Iran as this precarious, wobbling domino that could just hand the entire Middle East over to the Soviets.
Right. And the declassified sources highlight just how stark this contrast actually was. Under Truman, the U.S. was a highly reluctant mediator.
They didn't want to get their hands dirty.
No, they were actually worried about the catastrophic precedent a CIA-organized coup would set.
Which is pretty prescient, actually.
Very. But under Eisenhower, the default assumption just flipped to the absolute worst-case scenario. The thinking was, if Mokadeh fell on his own, or if the Iranian economy collapsed, the Soviets would inevitably march right in.
Okay, so because Eisenhower's administration was hyper-focused on this Cold War chessboard, the British government realized something critical, didn't they?
They did.
Because they had been pushing for a coup for months, but they knew Truman wasn't buying what they were selling. Now, with Eisenhower, they had the perfect opening. They just needed to change their sales pitch.
They absolutely did. British intelligence realized they couldn't just walk into the Oval Office and say, hey, please deploy your intelligence agencies to help us get our lucrative oil company back.
Right. That's not going to mobilize the Americans at all.
Exactly. So they completely reframed Mossadegh. They stopped talking about lost oil revenues entirely.
Just dropped it from the pitch.
Completely dropped it. Instead, they leaned incredibly hard into what one of the historical accounts literally calls the bogey of communism.
But wait, how do you even sell that? Because Mossadegh wasn't a communist, right? Iran wasn't a Soviet satellite. How did the British make this bogey of communism seem like an imminent reality to the Americans?
By pointing to the economic devastation that they themselves had caused.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The British laid out a very specific, terrifying argument to Washington. They pointed to the sheer economic desperation in Iran. We have to remember the mechanics of the Abadan oil embargo here.
Right, because this wasn't just a diplomatic freeze.
Not at all. The British Royal Navy physically blockaded Iranian ports.
They actually sent warships.
Yes. And they pulled out all the British technicians who actually knew how to run the massive Abadan refinery. On top of that, they froze Iran out of the global financial system.
So they essentially just strangled the Iranian economy, like they turn off the main tap of government revenue and the country just starts bleeding out.
Exactly. And that desperation became the core of the British pitch. They went to Washington and basically argued, look at this economic chaos. Mossadegh is desperate. He is losing his grip on the country. And this lack of funds is inevitably going to push him right into the arms of the Soviet Union for a bailout.
A self-fulfilling prophecy.
Or worse, they argued the economic collapse will result in a violent government takeover by Iran's pro-Soviet communist faction, which was the Tudeh Party.
Okay, so they are painting a picture of a country mere days away from being swallowed whole by the Red Menace. But let's look at the actual data here. Did the intelligence even support this doomsday scenario?
This is where we find just an incredible detail in the declassified dossiers. Despite this terrifying pitch from London, Western analysts at the time, the actual intelligence gatherers looking at the raw data, they privately doubted there was any real Soviet threat in Iran.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The Tudeh Party was noisy, sure, and they held rallies, but analysts did not believe they were on the verge of seizing the state.
Huh.
And Moscow wasn't even making aggressive moves toward Tehran.
Hold on. If the intelligence analysts are looking at the data and saying, you know, there is no imminent Soviet threat, how on earth did the White House justify launching a coup? Like, were they just lying to themselves? Or was this entire communist framing essentially just a cynical, targeted marketing campaign by British intelligence to trick the U.S. into acting as their muscle?
I mean, it's a question that gets right to the heart of how intelligence is used by policymakers. The factual record shows a massive disconnect between the intelligence gathering and the policy decisions.
Right.
The people at the very top in London and Washington essentially chose to elevate the worst-case scenario over the most likely scenario.
Wow.
British intelligence knew exactly which buttons to push with the incoming Eisenhower administration. They recognized that the fear of communism was the only key that would unlock American covert support. So they hammered that key regardless of what the baseline data suggested.
And the pitch worked.
It worked beautifully.
Because they successfully marketed this communist threat to a highly receptive audience, Washington pivoted practically overnight. They went from being a cautious mediator under Truman to an enthusiastic partner under Eisenhower.
Yes.
Because Britain had the motive, but they couldn't act without American resources. To get those resources, they needed sympathetic ears in Washington.
And they found the perfect audience and a very unique, incredibly powerful dynamic within the new administration.
Right. The Dulles brothers.
Exactly. The Dulles brothers.
Let's look at how power was actually structured here, because this concentration of influence is just wild.
It really is. When Eisenhower took office, he appointed John Foster Dulles as the Secretary of State. And shortly after that, he appointed his brother, Allen Dulles, as the director of the CIA.
I mean, it's like having the same person act as the coach calling the plays and the referee approving them, you know?
Pretty much, yeah.
Because normally the State Department is supposed to handle overt public diplomacy, right?
Yeah.
And the CIA handles covert action. Usually there is intense bureaucratic friction between the two.
Right, checks and balances.
Yeah, the State Department might argue that a covert coup will ruin diplomatic relations, and that acts as a check on the CIA's ambitions.
But when two brothers are running both wings simultaneously, that friction just vanishes.
It's gone.
Completely. John Foster and Allen share the exact same hardline anti-communist ideology. They didn't have to navigate interagency roadblocks or hold formal debates.
Right.
They could literally synchronize United States overt diplomacy and covert action over family dinners.
There is literally no one to blow the whistle. And that lack of friction allowed the anti-communist case for action in Iran to swiftly become official, unquestioned policy.
Exactly. And so, under the leadership of the Gulls brothers, the U.S. and Britain formally merged their covert plans.
Okay, here we go.
The CIA developed a massive operational blueprint called Operation TP-Ajax, often just referred to as Ajax. And this was designed to lock in perfectly with British MI6's existing, but previously stalled, plan for regime change, which was known as Operation Boot.
Okay, so Washington and London have agreed on the strategy. They've got the funding. But who actually gets sent in to execute this mess on the ground? You can't just, like, mail a coup blueprint to Tehran.
No, you need an operative. The CIA tasked a senior intelligence officer named Kermit Roosevelt Jr. to run the operation inside Iran.
And yes, for everyone listening, he was the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt.
He was. And he was the man on the ground, famously operating with suitcases of cash, tasked with turning this theoretical, high-level Washington-London strategy into a tangible reality on the streets of Tehran.
But Roosevelt faced a massive logistical and optical problem, didn't he? Because how do you overthrow a popular government without it looking like a blatant foreign invasion?
That's the million-dollar question.
If the CIA or MI6 just sent in military forces, it would completely backfire. It would unite the Iranian people behind Mossadegh, and it might actually provoke the Soviets to step across the border to counter a Western invasion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that constraint dictated the entire mechanics of the plot. They couldn't use overt military force. They needed a veneer of legal domestic legitimacy.
So it looks like an inside job.
Right. To make the coup look like a standard internal Iranian political maneuver, they had to leverage Iran's own internal power structure. Specifically, they needed the monarch.
So the entire scheme, all the millions of dollars and the intelligence gathering it, essentially funnels down to one single point of failure, right? Obtaining the signature of the young Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi.
Yes. We really need to understand the constitutional loophole they were trying to exploit here.
Okay, break that down for us.
So Iran had a constitution, and the prime minister, Mossadegh, was democratically elected by the parliament. But there was this murky, somewhat debated historical precedent that suggested the monarch had the authority to dismiss a prime minister when parliament was not actively in session.
Okay, so how does a piece of paper actually solve a military problem for the CIA?
By providing the military with a legal excuse to move. The intelligence agencies drafted royal decrees known as farmans.
Farmans.
The plot required the Shah to sign one farman, officially dismissing Mossadegh, and a second farman appointing a pro-Western military man, General Fazlollah Zahedi, as the new prime minister.
Got it.
If the Shah signed those papers, the military forces loyal to the plotters could claim they weren't staging a coup at all. They were simply enforcing the lawful orders of the king.
It provides the ultimate cover story. But obtaining that signature was notoriously difficult, right? Because the Shah was not some iron-fisted ruler at this point.
Oh, far from it. The Shah was in his early 30s. He was deeply insecure, highly indecisive, and he was acutely aware of Mossadegh's immense popularity with the Iranian public.
Right.
The Shah was terrified that if a coup attempt failed, he would be blamed, the people would revolt, and he would lose his throne permanently.
I just have to stop and marvel at the absolute precariousness of the situation. I mean, for all the power of the CIA and MI6, for all the sophisticated intelligence and suitcases of cash, their entire grand strategy hinged entirely on bullying an insecure 30-something monarch into signing a piece of paper.
It really did.
What does that tell you about the fragility of this plan? It's nuts.
It shows how incredibly contingent these covert operations actually are behind the scenes. Kermit Roosevelt and the British agents couldn't just ask the Shah nicely. They had to engage in this relentless, exhausting campaign of psychological pressure.
Yeah.
They sent a parade of emissaries to badger him day and night.
Didn't they fly his sister in, too?
They did. They even flew the Shah's own twin sister in from Europe just to convince him. They threatened that if he didn't cooperate, the U.S. and Britain would abandon him entirely, take their money, and just leave him to be overthrown by the communists anyway.
Man, they essentially cornered him in his own palace until he agreed to sign his country's democracy away.
Pretty much.
So, okay, we have the motive, the men, and the plan. But looking back at this entire buildup, it brings us to a massive, enduring historical debate.
It does. Having laid out how the British pitched the coup and how the Eisenhower administration enthusiastically funded it, we have to step back. because analyzing this historical pivot provides a really crucial framework for how we process global events today.
Yeah, because when you, as a listener, read the news today and you see a sudden diplomatic crisis or a justification for a foreign intervention, this history serves as a vital critical thinking tool.
Exactly.
It forces you to always ask, what is the stated public motive for this action versus the underlying economic or strategic interest?
And in the case of the 1953 coup in Iran, historians remain deeply divided over the true primary driver of the operation. This is not settled history by any means.
Right. We have to be impartial here because the debate asks a fundamental question. Was this coup truly driven by the genuine ideological fear of communism, you know, the Cold War containment lens we discussed, or was the bogey of communism merely a convenient, mutually agreed upon excuse to protect Western control over highly lucrative global oil reserves?
Right. It's the ultimate chicken or egg question for this era of history.
Mm.
You have one camp of historians who look at Eisenhower and the Dulles brothers and argue that they truly believed the containment theory.
They bought it.
They did.
Yeah.
They honestly thought that if Iran's economy collapsed because of the British oil embargo, the Soviets would walk right in and the West would lose the entire Middle East. They saw a legitimate existential threat.
But then you have the other camp of historians who point out the glaring baseline reality. The crisis only existed in the first place because the British refused to accept a 50-50 profit split on their oil extraction, which, by the way, was fast becoming the standard in other countries. So these historians argue that Washington and London essentially weaponized the terrifying language of the Cold War to justify what was basically an armed robbery of Iran's natural resources. Both elements, the oil and the anti-communism, were undeniably present in the room.
Oh, absolutely.
But assigning the relative weight to each motive is where the historical consensus just breaks down entirely. We're just reporting what the sources say, and they disagree.
And for anyone trying to make sense of this, the takeaway isn't that you have to pick a definitive side.
No.
The takeaway is a lesson in geopolitical literacy.
Huh.
It teaches you that in global politics, ideological fears are frequently used as marketing pitches to protect economic assets.
Mm.
You have to learn to separate the pitch from the underlying math.
Right. You have to look at the whole picture.
And this deep dive serves as perhaps the cleanest historical illustration of a terrifying reality. I mean, we have two administrations, Truman and Eisenhower. We have one country, Iran. We have one ongoing crisis, the nationalization of the oil industry.
Same exact variables.
Yes. But a partisan-flavored difference in worldview completely altered the trajectory of the 20th century. Truman's preference for diplomatic negotiation versus Eisenhower's preference for covert containment literally changed a nation's destiny.
It's staggering. The United States government looked at the exact same set of facts, the exact same intelligence reports, and made two entirely incompatible decisions within the span of just a few months.
And that shift in the lens decided the fate of Iranian democracy.
Well, let's recap the incredible journey we just went on today. We moved from a localized oil dispute under Truman, where the U.S. outright refused to act as the British muscle, to a full-blown Cold War emergency under Eisenhower.
Right, a shift driven entirely by British intelligence, successfully marketing the bogey of communism to an incoming administration that was, you know, fundamentally primed to see Soviet threats in every shadow.
And this alignment allowed the Dulles brothers to bypass normal government friction, seamlessly merging the efforts of the State Department, the CIA, and MI6. They deployed Kermit Roosevelt to Tehran, and the entire weight of Western intelligence focused on a relentless psychological pressure campaign, forcing a terrified Shah to sign those royal decrees.
And the stage is now perfectly set. As we wrap up this discussion, the decrees are drafted.
Yep.
The operatives are in place with their cash on the streets of Tehran. The constitutional loophole is ready to be exploited, and the trap is about to be sprung.
We are heading right into the 4 days in August that changed the Middle East forever. But before we go, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over on your own, building on that crucial detail we discussed about the intelligence analysts.
That's a huge point.
Yeah. We talked about how London and Washington lean so hard on the bogey of communism, even when the people looking at the raw data privately doubted the threat was real.
It really highlights the dangerous disconnect between ground-level facts and the narrative sold in the halls of power.
So here is the question you have to ask yourself. If a democracy's survival can be overturned by foreign capitals acting on threat intelligence that their own analysts privately doubt, how much of global history is shaped not by facts, but by the convenient stories superpowers choose to tell themselves?
That's the real question.
Are we living in a world driven by reality or by the filters we screw onto the lens? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives behind the history you think you know, and we'll see you next time as we jump into the absolute chaos of the coup itself.